resource for independent comics and their creators. Today we are reviewing Richard Stark's Parker, the third book in his series, The Score. I'm Thor Deacon.
I'm Brian Gardis.
I'm Herman Muir.
And so this is the third book, and the previous two have always been Parker going out and doing something on his own. And this is really a more Ocean's 11 style, where he's getting a group of people together to do a big score.
And see, that's where I had some problems with it. Because compared to the first two books, this one felt really bloated. I felt like there were so many, superfluous characters and scenes in this book that, it lost some of the, intensity of some of the earlier books. Because it's a really intense setup. They're going into a mining town. They're going to knock over the entire town, but it is, it's a town in a box, basically. There's one road in, one road out, and so it should be this really intense, you should be able to feel it the whole way.
Yeah, I really feel like it almost was over within, 20 pages. Like, the actual score was over within 20 pages, and that's the payoff of the book. It's supposed to be, the good part.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like there was too many places in here that either should have been edited out and scenes been extended, or I just felt like there wasn't enough book here. If he was going to keep the same plot points and scenes along the way, this maybe needed to be twice as big.
Right.
I agree. And I would have enjoyed it had it been twice as large, because, to be honest, there was so much that it seemed to be kind of glossed over, especially during it. It went so smooth that nothing went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And the best part about it that I did enjoy is the fact that the time period that he's working with, it made it make sense for how little they were really getting paid
for
the true score itself. But you look at it and...
So this is your first read of the series.
And this is my introduction to Darwin Cook and his style.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So what did you think of, first of all, the story and how it progressed?
Well, initially it was a bit of a shock, because you're reading through and the interaction with he and the guy that's following him as you're introduced mm-hmm. to the story, you go, okay, trying to get a feel for what's going to be happening here. He kills the man, and they go back and say, this is the guy that was supposed to tell you to just make sure everything was okay.
Right.
So then what was the point of him trying to stab you again? I don't know.
I felt like there was a couple of scenes like that, too, where you read it, and you're like, what did that add to this actual mm-hmm. story?
Yes.
Which is unfortunate that this is your first exposure to this, to Richard Stark's Parker, because the previous two books I felt were really tight and compact and explosive.
So let me ask though, since it's your first one, and there are minor references to the previous two books, talking about this is Parker, he's got a new face, things like that. How did you feel coming into it, without having read the first two, without understanding who Parker was? How did you feel? I mean, was this book accessible?
Yes, I did feel that it was accessible, and not only that, I didn't feel that I was missing a whole lot of his mm-hmm. background. As with a lot of books, there's always some mystery that's in the character, and so to be honest with you, there couldn't have even been two books before this. Mm-hmm. You can read it and move forward, because you get what's going on. It's pretty straightforward. They talk about the character interactions, and you just sort of get this introduction to, okay, we're going to let's speed up after you have this long, drawn-out introduction. And then let's get going. They already know each other. They work well together and know what's going to happen. It's just, there's just a couple pieces that you kind of wonder about. But to be honest, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed Parker as a character in and of himself. And as the story went, he grew based upon how people would talk about him or how they would act around him.
Yeah.
And that's really been the key of the first two books, is you realize quickly, how smart Parker is as, a criminal. Mm-hmm. And that was the really cool thing about this one, is it exposed a little bit more with, kind of the psychology that he used, so that he didn't have as many victims as a straight-up psychopath.
Right. But that was also one of my biggest problems with this book, is that Parker's a freaking idiot in this book.
Yeah.
The person who is setting up this score is a guy named Edgars. And Edgars has this all planned out, and he says, when he does it, that he's in it for the money and revenge. He says that to Parker. And Parker never once stops and says, what's the revenge aspect of this? And I felt like Parker is too smart of a character. He works so hard to have every angle covered that for him to never once ask, what's the revenge aspect and how could this possibly impact what we're doing?
See, I disagree, because I think that that would make him a perfect character. And I think that it showed kind of one of his weaknesses, which might be a little bit of greed, and really more the excitement of pulling off a score.
Yeah.
And so to me, that was kind of like a character flaw that needed to be revealed, because in the first two, he hardly has any. Like, you just see him doing almost perfect work on these big organizations.
But see, that was the delight of what was the second book? You know, going and seeing
The Hunter,
seeing how all those little pieces intricately fell into place to make it all work. That was so cool. And I can understand him overlooking something small, but when in the very first introduction, the guy says, I'm doing it for these two reasons, and Parker completely ignores the second reason, that I had a hard time swallowing.
I think that it was handled poorly, and I think that it could have been done better if maybe... and I haven't read the original story, so I don't know if it was a more subtle reveal in the story, and you didn't really realize that, and Darwin Cook made it a little bit harder here. But it should have been a little bit more subtle so that you didn't really catch on, like, right in the beginning. Like. Yeah.
But he does say, I mean, even Parker says to himself, and talking to himself, something's wrong with this. Mm-hmm. Something is not quite right. And it leads you to believe that the greed gets the better of him.
Mm-hmm.
But they, and which then also gets a little bit confusing, because previously in the book it talks about the fact that he gets the money to go on these hedonistic travels, but then he comes back because he needs something to do.
Yeah.
Well, it's, okay, well then does he need the money? Or is he just doing it for this perverse pleasure of, I want to see if I can do something?
I think that's exactly what it is. And I think that that's what really draws him is it's not the greed, but it's performing a score of this type.
Yeah, that you wouldn't normally be... You couldn't do something like this.
Yeah.
And but especially Parker can. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, he's like the one exception. And I think that that's the character flaw that was needed in this story. But I think that it was a little bit clumsily handled. And I don't know if that's the way it is in the original story or just how Darwin chose to represent it.
But good news was, at least it led to the story. Because if he had stopped about halfway through and was like, I think there's something wrong with you, the book would have ended.
Yeah.
So, but,
And that's the thing, that I feel like I need to review this book in two separate ways, because the book is, it's a good book, it's a good story, I was entertained the whole way through, but compared to the other two, so reviewing it as part of a series, I felt like it was definitely the weakest of the series, but...
I think it was by far the weakest of the series.
But I think that looking at the, you know, it compared to other books on the shelf that are coming out, it's a much stronger book than 90% of what's coming out right now.
So. Definitely. I mean, we've only talked about the story so far, and then there's not, you know, Darwin Cook's strength, which is the actual art, which is absolutely amazing. And I think that somehow it's getting better and more expressive in this book, which somewhat shocks me, because the first two were so great. And his use of the color. And so why do you think he used yellow in this book, where he's used more of a blue tone?
I thought it was because of the heat. They pull off this mining company, a copper mine.
Uh-huh.
And so the book is done in black and white, and then there's sort of yellow washes over it. And they talk about the heat of the location. And, you know, even when he's off on the tropical location, and they show him at the beach coming out of the water. And so there's just this sense of pervasive heat everywhere they go. Mm-hmm. And then even the night scenes, it seemed to work because then you get the glow of the headlights, you get the glow of the street lights. And so, I don't know, it seemed like a really natural color, but mm-hmm. I found myself noticing it a lot more in this book than I have in the previous two books because it seemed to enhance the story so much.
It really did. It worked very well for drawing you in as far as not just the darkness mm-hmm. from what was occurring during when they pull the job, because it tends to accentuate what exactly is occurring, and then going, okay, we have to work in this specific type of environment, but then also the fact that they're constantly commenting on the sulfur fumes
yeah.
and you know, that how they're having to interact with this stuff that's just unpleasant.
Another weakness for me of the book, going back to the plot, is really, when you think about a group coming together, there's a necessary piece for every person to perform. Like, I think about, like, Ocean 11,
yeah.
which is, like, a great story because each of these people is brought in on this score because they have a specific piece that they can add to this grandmaster plan. There was none of that here. It was just, you know, 13 thugs going out into, with a couple of, safe blowers.
Right.
And so that was another failing for me in this, you know, big score kind of a story, is there wasn't those jigsaw puzzle pieces fitting together.
Yeah, it's just, you bring in a bunch of heavies, control the people, and let's be done with this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you have the one person who can actually control people. There's only one guy.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing, they can actually manage a crowd. So you go, well, wait a second. Okay, then why is he... So he shows up to the police station. Okay, now he's... Here he is with the women at the call center. Okay, so then he leaves. So what are you doing with the people that are behind? And, of course, then you get to see what happens with Grofield.
Yeah,
you know, when he's left alone. But
that was such a cool... And see, I liked the character Grofield.
Oh, yeah.
Because Grofield is... He's one of the guys brought in, and there's Grofield in reality, and then there's Grofield in his own head. And I
yes.
loved the way that you know, Cook showed Grofield in his own head. I kept expecting it to go elsewhere. I figured that was the piece that was going to blow up. That Grofield in his own head, you know, off doing this, that, or the other, was going to be the piece that unraveled.
But that was
yeah.
the clever thing, right?
Yeah.
Because it's that piece that throws you off what is actually going to unravel
right.
it,
mm-hmm.
the whole scheme.
But that was the piece, you know, like I said, what I liked so much in the outfit, not in the outfit, was that the second book?
The Hunter was
the Hunter the second. See, I'm going to keep going back and back. The Hunter was, you know, there were little character pieces along the way where Cook used different artistic style to represent different characters or different actions. And I felt like Grofield was the place in this book where he was able
mm-hmm.
to do that, where he was able to very clearly delineate what was going on in Grofield's head and Grofield in reality just based on the art that he was choosing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there was only really three characters. There's Grofield, Parker, and Edgars.
Yep.
Yep.
Why were the other people necessary in so much of the beginning book? Like,
right.
In the beginning, it maybe should have been, like, centered around the interactions of these three people, and, oh, yeah, we got all these other people.
And like you said before, that's where the book could have exploded to about twice its size, where they go into a description of these other characters. Because you have a lot of pretty elaborate names to come up with to describe mm-hmm. characters that don't do anything.
Right.
Exactly.
Or the feeling that, you know, the difference between the two types of safe crackers.
Yeah.
There was like a whole discussion about one guy likes to use nitro and the other guy just likes to use a drill.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I felt like that was almost a throwaway.
I feel like this is the first time I felt like the book is the definitive version of this story.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like these other ones, the first two books, did a great job of telling a complete story in a new way. And I feel like this one maybe is failing. And I want to go back to the source material and read it, Because I feel like maybe that discussion of those two safecrackers, these other people, like all of that was expanded in the book and really necessary for the story.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't fit it in. And it was handled clumsily.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, let's see, how can I say this? Though it was, at least he was consistent in cutting everyone off.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it wasn't a matter of, okay, well, now we're going to expound on this particular individual and what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
No, he was pretty straightforward. He just cut everybody's part down.
Yeah.
That's the whole reason for the safecracker. He had to put it in there because otherwise it didn't make sense to have not one, but two safecrackers show
so
up.
So why isn't he editing the gang if he's not using them?
Yeah.
That's my big beef with this story.
I mean I get it, you know, logistically why they would need, you know, all the character, you know, all the players, why they need mm-hmm. so many bodies, but yeah, why to spend the page count
yes.
on all of this when, you know, the heist could have been expanded, or why, you know, Grofield, I mean, really could have been expanded. Something could have been expanded somewhere. Edgar's could have been a much more complex character.
Yeah, he really ends up being two-dimensional. His personality outside of Copper Cannon,
yeah.
and then, like, when he gets in there and he just becomes a psychopath.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was poorly done. Edgar's needed to be explained better. He wasn't even explained well with the
yeah.
surrounding characters who...
Mm-hmm.
Who Parker even questioned. He said, what's the story with this guy? What's going on? Oh, well, he was going to be indicted. Okay.
Yeah.
For what? Well, nothing stuck. Okay, but...
Another concern of mine is there's scenes where Edgar's is taking the girl, his, like, girlfriend or whatever, and they're doing some... Parker and him are doing some other things, and then the girl shows up with Parker later. And that was like a 20-page part of the book that had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
Unless, like, the girl is, like, the setup in the next book. But it's almost like that could have been an intro for the next book if that's the case. Because the way this book ended and that whole scene with Edgar's and the girl, that was totally not necessary
nope.
to this story in any way.
Yeah, they're, you know, for people who haven't read it, there's a big... basically argument where Edgar's the guy who is planning, or at least has come up with the heist. He's got a girl who I thought her introduction, Jean is her name. I thought
yeah.
her introduction was great. Edgar says, this is my girl Jean, and Parker's thinking
yeah.
to himself, she's not anybody's girl for very long.
Yeah, exactly.
That was a great introduction to her.
And she's well written, and not only that,
yeah.
well drawn, especially.
Yeah.
And not in like a tawdry way. I mean, it's very...
I don't know, she was a bombshell.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And represented as such. And it was well handled.
But, so she... I expected her character to be so much more, but basically her whole purpose in the story was to have an argument between Parker and Edgar's about whether she could come along or not, and the end decision was that she was going to stay in a hotel outside of town, and that was...
Not just outside of town, outside the state
lines. Outside of the state lines. It didn't seem... Yeah, I mean, that was another 20 pages that... You know, I mean, you didn't need to have it. You could still have the end scene where she is.
Yeah.
And the introductory scene where, you know, he says, this is my girl, and Parker says she's nobody's girl for very long.
Yeah.
And cut out, you know, the rest of that argument, and cut out the, you know, 10 pages or 20 pages where he takes her to her apartment or whatever,
yeah,
to pack
yeah.
up. And it still would have been... a perfectly fine ending scene to have Parker go and talk to her.
Okay, so then what was your thought in regards to the arms dealer? Because it seemed to be a lot of exposition in his dealing with the arms dealer.
See,
now,
when we're talking about
arms dealers, that's what was really crazy.
So what I got as we're talking about all of these different scenes that just don't really make sense in this story the way that it was handled. I feel almost like he's trying to stay too true to the source material and hitting all of these touch points
mm-hmm.
and not doing a true adaptation where he's editing out these different scenes. Like, I imagine that these are probably all in the book, they're just way condensed in this book, mm-hmm. and it makes it a clumsy transition from scene to scene to scene. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I imagine is going on, is that he's really trying to stay faithful to the book, and the book has the time to go through and walk through all of these different elements and make it seem relevant and transition smoothly. And he just can't do it. Darwin Cook just can't do it here.
Yeah, to answer your question, though, what did I feel about the arms dealer, mm-hmm. the blind arms dealer who works in the, you know, out of the back of a toy shop?
Yeah.
I thought that revealed a lot about Parker as a character having that scene, because, you know, here's this blind guy who's an arms dealer. So, you know, the average person off the street would have a modicum of sympathy for this blind guy. I mean, just, you know, because he's blind. Mm-hmm. Not only does Parker have no sympathy for him, but then Parker proceeds to basically outthink him and expose all the little tricks that this guy's trying to pull.
Right.
And then ends up basically setting his own price and his own shopping list, which is very different from what this arms dealer is offering him.
Right.
And I thought that that revealed, again, just a little bit more, or maybe not revealed, but reinforced a little bit more about Parker.
Okay, I can go agree with that. That makes a lot of sense, which would also explain why he completely threw away the interaction with the other arms dealer.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, it's his go-to guy for guns.
Right.
And that was the, and it went, but that's the way he should have handled a lot of the other characters. It's just a guy that I use, we don't need to talk about it.
Yeah.
And so I think had he done that with a few of the other characters in here, hey, I'm going to line up X, Y, and Z here, their names, they're going to go ahead, mm-hmm. they're going to manage this, and you move on. I think he was trying to just go, okay, yeah, they are people I'm using on the team, but we need to at least talk a little bit about them so there's some empathy for them. You know, the interaction at the end of the book, where mm-hmm. you have the guy that goes stir-crazy and is trying to run.
Right.
You don't know enough about him, or...
Yeah, I feel actions. Nothing about that character.
Yeah,
and I almost feel like there's no tension of him leaving. I don't know why, but I felt no tension about him, like, screwing them over. And there should have been a huge buildup of tension there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and not only that, they didn't really have a problem with him exploding in a fiery ball of death.
No.
You know, it was, they're kind of like, oh, well, our split's bigger. And then, but they also talked about the fact that his money, or like his share was in the car.
Yeah.
But the car blew up and was on fire, but everybody got paid more. So, but that's... You know, we're just let that go.
Well, there was less people. I mean,
there's fewer people at the end of the score than there are at the start of the score.
That's true.
No, it's, you know, but I thought that the tension just wasn't there through the whole book, which it could have been, and it gets back to the art where I felt like he was building it with the pervasive heat with. Everybody's on edge, and he does a good job showing how, like the truck driver, the guy who's hired to drive the truck, that's his whole, well, not his whole job, but that's his niche role, to drive the truck.
The perspiration on his face.
Yeah, the perspiration
on the hill.
That one really showed the tension and all the different ways this could go wrong.
And that's just crazy, right? Like, the most tense moment is when they're driving a truck down...
An empty truck.
...down to hide it. That's the biggest tension. The whole score and how it falls apart, I felt almost no tension. The stir-crazy moment, I felt almost no tension. And I don't know why that was, but it shouldn't have been.
But the art... Oh my God! When they tell Parker that the guy is, you know, basically grabbing his share and bolting, I love that scene. Just where they wake him up, and you can see just a couple of figures, you know, standing there in the darkness, and it was just again another really cool moment. I mean, that's the thing is that the art in this book. I think you're right. I think Cook's art is getting stronger. There was such a heavy feel for the time period, because you talked about how you know, the time period was so important to this for how little they were getting paid, how difficult it was for them to get guns, and the fact that walkie-talkies were a big deal and had to be set specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Cook nailed the time period so well with this, even more so than he's done in the previous two books. The previous two books, you know, kind of had that retro feel to them, but really felt like they could have been in any particular time period.
Yeah.
Whereas this one felt so firmly rooted in the 50s, and his art just sold it.
Yes. So there's a page on here that's the reveal that Edgar's has cracked. And there's this great two-panel at the bottom of page 109 where you see Edgar's with the crazy face.
Mm-hmm.
But Darwin Cook does two panels here, and he sets it slightly askew so that you see that he is fully cracked. And it's just the great reveal. They don't show Edgar's this whole time, and it's kind of like the one buildup in the actual score piece of the book, where you have a buildup, there's tension, and then a reveal at the bottom of page 109.
Mm-hmm.
And that's solely because of the art.
Yeah, I could do nothing but look at an artist's edition of Darwin Cook. You know, get one of those big IDW artist editions.
Full size, yeah.
And that's the thing, you know, the Martini edition, which collects the first two volumes and apparently has a short story in it, which won the Eisner for best short story.
Mm-hmm.
Those are actually oversized. So they're you know, I don't know, 50% larger than this or something.
Uh-huh.
And I really think that would be an even better format for this, that to really just hammer home the art aspect of it. In fact, when they were getting ready to come out with The Hunter, they came out with a, I don't know, it was like a buck or something. It was really cheap, but it was oversized collection of the first 12 pages or something like that.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I know that this is easy to stick on, you know, bookshelves and easy to have in, you know, Borders or Barnes and Nobles or whatever is still out there. But God, you know, I feel like the art is almost getting shortchanged because it's so good. I want that to be blown up to really pour over.
Well, I agree, but I think that it would be better in a special edition as opposed to the actual copy, so that the people like us that really appreciate the art would spend the extra money. Because, honestly, I just want these stories to get out there and be read, and I don't know if people are going to read them with, like, a $40 or a $50 edition, oversized edition, you know, for buying three of those now.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, that's the thing, is that even as much as I'm torn about how I feel about the score, and again, it comes down to, as the third book in the Parker series, I'm disappointed. As an individual book compared to the other books on the stands, I'm pleased.
Oh, definitely.
But
I mean, I feel like we've had a lot of complaints about this book, but that's because the other two were so great.
Yeah.
Like, this book is still better than most of the stuff that you're reading on the shelves now.
Oh, that's the truth.
And that's the thing, is that I can't wait for the next Parker book.
Definitely.
I mean, I am now, I mean, even though this one was not, you know, my favorite, when volume 4 comes out, it's on my pull list. It's, you know, I am so excited. I mean, we are lucky we get books from IDW to review.
Yeah.
I still buy Parker.
Oh, yeah. They look great on your shelf.
I loved it.
Yes.
It was fantastic.
I
will have to say that, like, if it were not for the art, I can't really say that I would be that excited to read the next one. Without his art that's in the book, I
think that I'm going to loan you the first two and you're going to read those, and I think you'll have a different opinion.
Yep.
And it's almost maybe better that you're coming in with this book and you're going to read the other two, because you're going to be like, okay.
Yeah.
Well,
nice.
If you were just reading the story, no art whatsoever in the score, it would have been a little too light.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree.
But
his
art brings out enough depth that you get sucked in. And I mean, I sat down and I didn't stop.
Yeah.
I read it all the way through.
And you know, the thing is that, I mean, I've enjoyed Darwin Cook's art over the years. I really enjoyed the DC, what was it, New Universe or whatever it was. It was a two-volume set that he did that had a very retro feel to it. Because his art has
like
that...
New Frontier.
New Frontier, that's the one. New Frontier.
Oh, yeah, okay.
It has that, you know, sort of retro feel to it, but I've never had the experience with his art where I'm like, this is what he was born to do, until I read Parker.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is I feel like Darwin Cook was born to adapt Parker. And, you know, I mean, I feel bad shoving someone into a corner like that, except that, I mean, he is just hammering it so well. And now we're in a time where, you know, Mad Men is so huge.
Mm-hmm.
There's this sort of 50s revival going on.
Yeah.
I really think that this is the kind of time when, you know, Cook is really going to get a nice spotlight put on him. And it makes me wonder, okay, so then what's next? I mean,
yeah.
I'm trying to think how many books he's signed on for. I think 7 or something like
for
Parker.
So it would make sense then that perhaps his next couple of books, he's going to be working more teamwork versus on his own.
Yeah,
it looks like based upon what you've been saying about the first two books, it was more him sort of getting his bearings and moving forward,
mm-hmm.
and now it's him doing his real work, how he makes a living.
The one thing about this book is it's really made me want to go back. The first two didn't make me want to go back and read Richard Stark's original material because it was so well handled, but this book actually makes me want to go back and read the score as an original, as the
just,
original material.
Just get that
yeah.
those pieces that are...
And so maybe I might move on from there and read the next series
mm-hmm.
of books before it comes out with Darwin, which is interesting because I hadn't had that desire before this book.
Yeah, the first two really felt like their own discrete piece, like you had everything you needed or wanted. Whereas this one, it left me feeling like, I don't know, there's something I'm missing.
Yeah.
Well, so I hate to steer you guys in a different direction, but so let's talk about the ladies in the book.
Okay.
Because to be honest, I got to talk about the ladies.
Okay.
We've already discussed how it's Jean,
mm-hmm.
Edgar's girl, how well she was handled
mm-hmm.
as far as her introduction.
Mm-hmm.
Very quick, to the point, you knew exactly who she was and how she was.
Yep.
And then finished up the book doing the exact same thing, which
mm-hmm.
was just extremely well done. Then you have Grofield's girl.
Right.
Who, you know, to be honest, someone that would want to hook up with the masked man that's robbing her
mm-hmm.
and then seems to have the wherewithal to understand the lifestyle she's getting into.
Mm-hmm.
This little, you're kind of, okay, we know she's not right.
Well, I think also that she comes from a small town that she doesn't enjoy. And so she sees an exciting way out.
I saw her almost as, bear with me for a minute.
Sure.
I saw her as almost the female Parker, in the sense that she was the smartest person in the room. She was controlling all
mm-hmm.
of it. She was really in control of Grofield.
Yes.
She was the one who, you know, was sitting around at the you know, phone exchange,
mm-hmm.
you know, bored out of her mind, plotting and scheming to get her way out of this small town. I really felt like, she was the smartest person in the room, and this was her one ticket out of there. And she held her own against Parker at the pit.
That's the one scene that really stands out to me, is that she's there almost on even footing with Parker. I mean, you kind of see the transition in the panels where Parker is above her in all of the panels.
Mm-hmm.
And then at a certain point, he becomes even with her. And you kind of see how the perspectives have shifted, and now Parker's okay with her because he realizes... she's not some dizzy blonde.
Yeah.
And then he makes a comment about her in his conversation with the girl that he's now hooking up with.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess we all can't be as lucky as Grofield.
Right.
And so, it's... my wonder is she going to show up later?
You know, I see Parker as almost that James Bond character. Where he, you know, he starts with a dame, he ends with a dame. Different dame, of course. There might be a dame in the middle. And then the next book, it's like the name was never there.
If there's one theme with Parker throughout these first three books, at least, is that he doesn't stick with any one person. He doesn't have... Grofield isn't in the other books. And the main characters in the other books that he's teaming up with
don't show up
again.
Yeah.
Like, he just sort of bounces along and uses the people that he needs.
Yeah. And I like the way you put that. Uses the people that he needs. And I think he sees women that way. I think that somewhere in the back of his mind he wants to settle down, because he talks about that. He talks about that. But he has such a distrust because he uses people and he knows people use him that he can't ever see someone as just being.
Mm.
And that's why, you know, he even says, how can I get as lucky as, you know, lucky as Grofield, but there would be something wrong with her too.
Yeah.
And I think that he's looking at it, like I said, I mean, she's smart enough. I mean, she'll hold her own, and maybe she would be the perfect girl for Parker.
Well,
because
not even for Parker, just somebody that would show up as someone to be used later in the scheme. You know, it would make sense that, okay, I found something I might be able to use later.
Yeah.
But based upon what you said, you're absolutely correct. Probably.
Yeah, I love him as that James Bond character. It's the, you know, he's got the one, each of these sets up as their own distinct thing. I mean, you can go into any James Bond movie. You know, there's been, 27 of them or something. Yeah. You can drop into any of them and very quickly figure out who all the characters are and what the relationship is and what the plot is going to be. And Parker, I feel the same way. You can drop in any of these. You can enjoy it. You can know there was stuff that happened before. Like in James Bond, there's always some reference to, you know, this happened back in Tangiers or whatever. But this is the opposite side, you know? Whereas James Bond is the good guy who is making everything safe for the world. Parker's the guy that's, you know, knocking something over. He's the guy that's breaking in and getting the money so that he can go off to Maui for 6 months.
Mm-hmm. So this is $25 as a hardcover. How do you feel about the price?
I'm torn because, like I said, you know, as the Parker books, boy, that was not as good. But did I get a lot of enjoyment out of it? Yeah. Did I sit down with friends and show them the art and go, you've got to see this and look at this design and, you know, look at the craftsmanship? Sure, but boy, $25? Eh, $19.99 and I'm sold and it's coming home, you know, no problem. Boy, 25 is a tough sell.
Yeah, I pretty much fully agree with that. $20, and that's a good deal for that book. It's interesting because I didn't feel that way with the other two.
Nope.
But after reading this one, I don't know, the story doesn't hold up as well.
Hmm.
How about you? $25?
That's a little rich for my blood on 25. But again, they're probably pricing it because they know that within XYZ number of months, they're going to have to drop it down to about 20.
Right. Well, and, you know, and then, of course, that's the you know, MSRP. You go to Amazon, you go to your local comic shop, and most of them will give you a, you know, 10 to 15% off.
In which case, their selling price point that they're expecting is really
$20.
Somewhere between $15 to $20 is what they're expecting to sell. $25 is... If we mark it for 25, we know we're going to get at least this out of it, no matter where it sells.
You know, I think, though, that the nice thing is that, you know, because it won the Eisner, I think that people are going to check this out. And because it is so strong compared to what else is on the shelves, that people will pick it up, people will enjoy it, and then they'll go back and find those first two books and just, you know, hopefully be blown away by it. Because... it is, like I said, I mean, it's what comics should be. It is that really perfect blend of visual storytelling and story that this book, I you know, as much as I'm like you, I want to go back and reread the original, the visuals sell it so well that I don't know, I have a hard time imagining it just as prose.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
All right, you've been listening to SDR, your online resource for independent trades and comic book creators.